Hello and welcome to Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello, it's us again, and it's just been the autumn equinox, so Olban Eldred, I believe, to the Druids. We can't let that go by without a little comment. And I just wanted to say two things about the equinox. First is, I find it wildly exciting, frankly, that the equinox happens all over the world. Equal night, equal day, equal night, 12 hours of each,
everywhere.
And that blows my little brain cells. It really does, because, you know, it's we're heading into autumn over here, they're heading into spring over there on the other side, and all the places in the middle are all kinds of different times and different seasons and all the rest of it, all of the rest of the time. And then twice a year, we all get 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night. And there is something about that that really, really speaks to the balance that I always find myself thinking about at this time of year. Mm. So equi equal nox night.
Yeah.
Equal night, equal day, equal night. Equally between the seasons of the year, if you like, in a way, in the way that autumn and spring kind of are equally between the lightest and the darkest of whatever the weather brings, but also in terms of the light and the dark in everything. I think we all tend to mull over this stuff at this time of year. And where I always get round to is balance, that things so beautifully expressed by the Limnesca that I'm always rambling on about. I'm not sure that I ramble on about it
so much. You don't very much.
No, but I ramble on about it a lot in my in what I offer by way of workshops and trainings, and that the idea of balance, so the still point between two opposing equals or between two and-ands.
For those who don't know, what is the Limnesca?
So the Limnesca, yes, good point, is it looks like a figure of eight, but perfectly equal in its two kind of circle-ish parts, but lying on its side. And it is a mathematical symbol for infinity, so the infinite. So it becomes very easily translated into a symbol meaning the divine, but also a symbol which clearly speaks to polarity, whether it is and or. And it can be very much be sort of either other as well. But anyway, so it's a beautiful symbol for balance. And you can imagine you've got your one circle on one side and your one circle on the other side, each speaking to something. And for me, when I translate that into the word balance, and this time of year brings up this subject in me really, really particularly, because this is the time where the abundance of the hedgerows is kind of at its peak. You know, certainly around here, you cannot go out your door and turn in any direction without finding something that you could harvest. And that idea of harvest is so ingrained in our culture, but so utterly and totally out of balance. So we, in the West, in consumer culture, view that which we could harvest as a commodity to which we have a right, rather than as a gift which requires the reciprocity of our gratitude, but also as we as human beings in our culture regard it as like ours, the humans. And we completely forget that we are one among uncountable numbers of beings who eat mushrooms or blackberries or rose hips or whatever it is. And so we have completely and utterly lost sight of what Robin Wall Kimmerer calls so beautifully the honourable harvest. And that's not her expression, that's the honourable harvest is I imagine, a worldwide concept, but certainly that would be the English translation of the American concept of the Honourable Harvest. And, you know, we do have it here. When I was taught to harvest, what do you call it when you go wild?
Foraging.
When I was taught to forage by my mum, it was very much, there are rules to this. You never pick the first one you see, and you, in case it's the last one, mm-hmm. in case you're picking the only one.
Yeah.
And you don't pick all of them ever, because by potentially picking the first one or picking all of them, you are not only denying other humans the opportunity to harvest, you're denying all the other creatures that also eat that thing, and you are potentially denying the being itself the opportunity to reproduce. Because what we eat, the fruit, whether it's a fungal fruiting body or a fruit or a sheaf of wheat or anything, that is how the plant reproduces.
Yeah. And we're also in a culture where we allow companies to create foods that don't reproduce.
Yeah.
To control the financial flow or control the kind of seed. So the way we've lost touch is just exponentially, phenomenally worse than when Silent Spring was written.
Totally. Oh my God, yes. Yeah. Inconceivably, incomparably worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, hideous.
Oh, yes. I am so grateful that this year I've got raspberry plants. I've got an autumn raspberry.
Yum.
And every morning I can go out and pick about three.
Yum.
And it's perfect, because that's my peon of praise sorted for the morning, to walk outside in the beautiful air, even if it's mizzling a bit, be grateful for the mizzle, because the apples are really bad this year because the weather's not been right for them. They were beautifully pollinated, bless them, but anyway, but just to go out and pick three golden raspberries, because I've got the golden variety, and just be so infinitely connected to the... Well, everybody knows what it's like to take a blackberry or a berry. So it's alive. You take it straight to your mouth. You are exchanging energy.
Yeah.
It's giving you its life force. It's not even dead when you eat it.
No. And the utter moment of that gratitude, that's, to me, that's such a massive part of what's missing, of what's broken in what should be the balance between... our need, our greed on the one hand, and all else that is, which also has need and doesn't appear to have any greed on the other hand.
Yeah. I had a conversation with my nephew last week, because we've been doing a lot of family stuff with mum's funeral and stuff, and he's a vegetarian for ethical point of view. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, okay, Russell, please talk to me about this. What's the plan? Because the thing about all liberals... Richard Rohr says, and I think he's got a good point, is that liberals want to change the world. And I'm using liberals to mean people who are seeing things wrong with society and wanting to address them. That's my code word for liberal. It may mean other things for other people, but people who want to change the world for better quite often protest about the old and change their own lifetime. But we've got to have a plan. How do we work this through? I said, so how do we stop people eating meat? And bless him, he just said, we don't need to stop people eating meat. We just need to change the system so that there isn't any corporate greed or any major abattoirs or something. And I just went, oh, my kind of person.
Yay.
You know, and this stuff in the news at the moment about the carbon dioxide shortages. There's shortages of manufactured carbon dioxide, which are used for preserving meat and in the killing in the major abattoirs. It's used to stun the animals.
Wow, I had no idea.
I didn't really either. But basically, the replies that I'm getting from local farming friends or local farmers is, why the hell do you need that anyway? If you take care of your livestock properly, if they are slaughtered correctly with a stun gun so that it's immediate...
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to vacuum pack your meat, just sell it.
Yes.
Fresh-ish. And it's not meant to be utterly fresh. It's meant to age a little. You know, so why do we even need this? So this whole also it's in for beer. So pubs will be in trouble as well, the CO2. But it's all basically, this is only a problem because we've got things so wrong.
Yeah, totally. You don't, I mean, as far as I understand it, I don't think you need, well, you definitely don't need, people brew perfectly nice beer from scratch with hops and you know, whatever else. They do not need to apply fake CO2 to it.
But because it's corporate, we do.
Well, I mean, you know, each one of us has the choice not to buy any of that stuff. And so it won't be a problem for us.
It's interesting. I've been saying to a few people, yes, but it costs the earth.
Indeed.
And they usually go, no, it doesn't. It's really cheap. Yeah. Let's go through that sentence again.
Listen to the words. Yeah.
Listen to the words again. But I have... Go on.
I was just going to completely derail the conversation by saying, tell me about your mother's funeral, but...
Oh, well, I'd like to sort of talk a little bit about autumn and how when we had the solstice, I was talking to you about a sadness that I had.
Oh, yeah.
And it just sort of made clear to me why I do have that sadness. And a friend pointed it out because he was sad because the swallows had gone.
Mm.
And it's that kind of sorrow, really. But also, there's a sadness for the fruits of the land, the animals and the vegetables that don't make it. And I actually, it's probably part, just part of my makeup, but I'm growing squashes outside, and one of them I accidentally broke the stem. I put it back together with sellotape, which always works with pumpkins, but obviously doesn't work with squashes. Right. And it died, and there was sorrow that it wasn't going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a butterfly every now and then. I mean, if Lan's going to be cutting down the nettles, I go through them first to see if there's anything I can bring into my school butterfly net to make quite sure that it, you know, has food and it can raise itself. And every now and then there's one that just doesn't get out of the pupa in time.
Mm.
And its wings set and it's doomed. You know? And I know it's probably just me being soft because nature is red in tooth and claw, but there's a sort of, oh, you didn't reach your full potential. And that is kind of relevant because... leading the funeral for my mum last week, my brother and I shared the eulogy. And I was just so aware of who she would have liked to have been.
Mm.
But couldn't because she was born 30 years too early.
Mm.
And I always, with any eulogy, I will always say I want to talk about the person. Because I don't want it just to be beloved mother, beloved wife, beloved grandma. Because, how you are in relationship to others is very important. But who was she
at the
soul level? And so I was talking about my mother having the most beautiful hair, the colour of a coal scuttle, copper coal scuttle, and a beautiful soprano voice, which was most annoying in church because it was louder than everybody else's. But it took a while to get you... And she played the piano beautifully, and she was an amateur dramatic actress, and she was a really talented writer. We only discovered after she died that she'd written a whole autobiography by hand, all about her childhood in the 1930s, and her father had a Rolls-Royce carriage-making business, and she apparently drove one of his cars at 100 miles an hour down the Hagley Road in Birmingham when she was 17 or something like that.
Whoa.
And all sorts of this stuff. And you could... And my dad called her his bright, beautiful girl when they got married. And I don't know what would have happened if she hadn't had postnatal depression. Mm. Maybe she would have gone on with acting or singing. Maybe she would have felt more fulfilled in herself instead of having to see her daughter do all the things that she couldn't. And there was, it was good for me to experience that sorrow, both for the life she didn't have and for the mother I never had.
Yeah.
Because you could see that her disappointment coloured everything.
Yeah. In the book as well, in what she'd written, was it?
I haven't got that far through it yet, but the holiday diary, she always wrote holiday diaries as well. And they were beautifully written. But you can see the wound.
Yeah.
And my brother had a really big laugh about it, but it does sort of make the point of just one thing. There's got to be one thing that's wrong. How was the wedding? It was marvellous. Just one thing. The bride looked like a meringue, you know. Yeah. How was this? Just one thing. And she was describing a meal, I think it was an anniversary meal my father took her to at Port Merion. And it was exquisite. It was obviously absolutely exquisite. And then she had to write, but the lobster could have been hotter.
Yeah, just not able to ever really sit in the gratitude.
No, I'm not anywhere in that world. I don't know what temperature you're supposed to eat a lobster.
Aww.
But it was so sweet, but it just summed her up so beautifully, you know.
Mm. And I have to admit, I'm blown away and terribly impressed that you managed to to be the one to take your own mother's funeral. I mean, that was that not just incredibly difficult?
No, because it meant I could go into show mode.
Right.
I had a lot of organising to do, and a lot of people are grieving for her in ways that I'm not grieving for her. You know, I have sorrow, mm-hmm. and there are poignant moments, but I'm glad, you know, she was more than ready to go. She'd been here too long. Mm. And I know she's safe and happy on the other side. You can get sparkles come through sometimes. My bishop was brilliant, got her straight through, which was really great because she was a bit lost, bless her. And it was... It just felt like the right thing to do. There were no vicars who knew her well enough.
Right, yeah.
And there's nothing worse than that's why people want these pure cremation things, because if you get the funeral director or some minister you don't know to do the funeral, they don't even know the person. They're not going to talk about the peccadilloes and the fun and the this. So for a start, it was very important for me to do the eulogy because it would be about her.
Yeah.
And bless him, my brother... read his half, but I still wrote both of them. And there was one of these joyful little moments later at the wake when one of my mother's friends, who's a bit too close to her, said, "I really liked Michael's part of the eulogy, didn't you?" You know, and I thought, uh-huh, and I wrote that half too. Yeah. I didn't have to say it.
Yeah.
So what, was it difficult? Yes. But it was more difficult... No, wrong word. It was important, and I hope this doesn't sound like ego. It was the only opportunity I've ever had to show my family who I actually am as a minister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they came to my ordination, but they've never seen me do a mass or do the work I did in hospices or the teaching work. They've never been interested in it. They don't come to the Methodist churches that I do services in or anything like that. They've never seen it, and they've never really... valued it.
Yeah.
And not that they have to value it, but they've never seen me as it.
Yeah.
And to be able to take my mother's funeral was actually just an example of this is what a minister does. This is where the minister is detached, compassionate, involved, and yet separate.
Yeah.
You know, because the oddest thing, I was saying this last night in the Kabbalah group, you have no idea how much power you have as a funeral minister. At that point, the people in the Kremlin would do anything you told them.
Wow.
And it's such an important thing not to misuse that power or to be slovenly about that power. And I had to say to God, I'm really going to need help here. Mm. And the week before, the bishop had been staying, and he'd introduced me to my power animal,
mm-hmm.
which I'd not met before. And I was able to say to Lion before the funeral, will you please visualise the power animal with me to give me strength? This is cracking me up. Because he did, all the way through the funeral, he held the energy of my power animal being with me.
Oh.
And that was such love.
Yeah, beautiful.
It was such love. And my voice cracked a few times, and I did shed tears, but it was what you do. And I didn't mean to be arrogant afterwards. People said, I don't know how you could do that. And I said, it's what I do. I've done funerals for suicide children and murdered people.
Yeah.
Doing one for somebody I loved shouldn't be a problem. No. Because I love all of them.
Yeah.
You know, when I do a funeral, I will always see if I can contact the soul.
Yeah.
You know, this is your funeral. I am your minister. What do you need? Is there anything you need here?
And was she there, or she'd already been got put through?
I didn't see her, but my father showed up.
Mm-hmm.
He was standing at my right shoulder trying to tell me how proud he was. And I just said, bug off, I cannot handle that right now. Because if I'm in show mode, you know, if I'm in, this is the minister detached to merciful mode, yeah. I don't need to be brought back down to my child.
Yeah.
With my daddy telling me he's proud of me. You can tell me afterwards, thank you, but no.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely get it. Yeah. So does that mean, therefore, that there is a bit of you, Maggie, the woman, Maggie, the child of that mother, who needs the closure of a funeral because Maggie, the child of that mother, wasn't there. You were in show mode?
Absolutely. I didn't go to my mother's funeral at all.
Yeah.
There was a moment when I was standing at the front. Everybody, she wrote out her absolute instructions for it. So we were able to, Michael was able to start his eulogy by saying, "It'll come as no surprise to you that in line with her favourite radio show, this funeral was written out in detail with no deviation, repetition or hesitation." And so it was, you know, it was a show. Yeah. It wasn't the funeral that I would have written, which was also sort of helpful in a funny kind of way.
Yeah.
But as soon as everybody was already in when the car arrived, I used a lovely funeral director. If you're in the Midlands, a natural undertaking, they're great. It's all women. They use an electric car. They can hire you in another car if you want it. And beautifully done. And I said to them, if you can get her wedding ring off, please do, but don't cut it.
Mm.
She wanted me to have it, but I don't want it cut. And they just said, oh, a bit of lavender oil will sort that. And I thought, oh, that's girls. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
And they did. And they gave it to me on the day in the most beautiful little pouch.
Oh.
You know, that little extra trouble that they took was really, really nice. But the point being, I met them. They were hanging, a couple of them were there before the hearse arrived, and then the electric hearse arrived and I met it, everybody else was in. And there was just this cardboard funeral, and I got the flowers which her friend Fel had made, we were putting on it. And it was fascinating because there was a point at which you say, I am here, click, and you just move over.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody in that coffin. This was... not so much a performance. This is
what you do.
This is what
job,
I do.
So you show up.
Yeah. Yes, this is what I do. So what I did when we came home. So no, I didn't go. And I just actually said that quietly to somebody in the afternoon because I just realised it. I didn't go to my mother's funeral.
Mm.
So when I came home, when we got home that night, I had a really long bath and I went to my mother's funeral.
Ah, well done. Yeah,
and good. I wept.
Yeah.
I thought they were bloody good eulogies, I have to say.
That vicar, she's great.
Yeah, oh, but the one the man did, the brother, you know, a brother.
Oh,
all
was
that,
better, yeah.
That was even better. That was funny.
People are so horrid and so, so often so completely transparent.
Yes. Oh, my
God. Dearie me. How are we doing for time?
22 minutes. We're absolutely fine.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
There's more we can talk about.
Okay. Jolly good. So the other thing that has been pottering about in my mind is, am I allowed to change subject now?
Yeah.
Oh, jolly good. Okay. Is that following last week's, I had a lot of people, either by private email or by actual ear, as it were, mouth to ear, saying, oh my goodness, that thing of... if you don't transmute it, you will transmit it.
Yeah.
My goodness, we did hit a spot with that.
Yes.
And I've sent out a few emails saying to them what you said to me, which was, please read Richard Rohr's book. Tell me again what it's called.
Things Hidden is the one that I'm reading at the moment.
Things Hidden. Okay. And that's the one that begins with that.
No, it doesn't begin with that. It's right in the heart of it. This is the trouble with these great teachings. You get called an expert when you take a smidgen out of it. Mm-hmm. So people will say, oh, brilliant, where is that? And I say, you kind of got to get the whole book to find it. But also in he has daily meditations, which are free.
Mm-hmm.
Which you can get from cac.org. And you'll find that once you know that the message is, if you don't transmute, you will transmit, you'll find it in everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But you won't find the phrase that often. And I first heard him say it when I went to Albuquerque on my pilgrimage. And he said it in, the Wisdom of Scripture, which is an audible book, an audible talk I've downloaded and I'm listening to. So some of his talks, he talks about it, but it is the entire message of his work. But if you want to start finding out about how we do transmit as opposed to transmuting, his book Falling Upward, which is all about what he calls the false self and the true self,
mm-hmm.
And how to recognise the false self in us when we will transmit. And there's a follow-up called Immortal Diamond, which is how to live in the true self. So Falling Upward and Immortal Diamond, I would recommend them to anybody with any interest in actually the spirituality of their psychology.
Mm-hmm. But also with a very particularly Christian
slant. It is a Christian slant. And I find that really useful because he just opens it up into what Christianity was meant to be. Like all the roots of the faith, it's about love. There's nothing but love.
Okay.
And that one of the things that stops us transmuting is how we identify with our pain. We talked about this a lot mm-hmm. before, as in if your pain identifies who you are, you need to transmit it.
Yes, or you're going to be stuck in that because that becomes your identity.
Yeah, and it is your identity, so it will be projected out towards anybody else. Mm. And it's really difficult for a lot of us nowadays to realise that we are taking our significance from all the wrong things. So we take our significance from wealth, possessions, money, mm-hmm. because we worship mammon.
Yeah.
And if you take your significance from ephemeral things, you will never feel ultimately significant. You will always be in pain and you will always transmit.
So this speaks very beautifully to something I was mulling on my way over, actually, as you said that Richard Rohr is taking this back to its roots, and the roots of Christianity is love. And that was a question I was going to ask you, actually, was, but I haven't found a way to turn it into an actual question. But where it began was with me thinking that I have a conversation with the spirits a lot where the answer turns out to be, because I want to do, in inverted commas, the right thing. Mm. I want to be a blessing, not a curse. Yeah. I want to be, to do as little harm as possible and as much good as possible, all in, I guess, in kind of inverted commas in a way, because I also want to be super clear on what is that? What do I mean by harm? What do I mean by good? Who am I gooding or harming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I thought, well, for me, that and it harm none is like, that's the kind of fundamental tenet, if you like, of what I guess we're calling witchcraft. Love is the law, love under the will.
Yeah.
Statement one.
Yeah.
Number two, do what thou wilt and it harm none.
Yes. Oh God, that rider is so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is, do what they will also speaks to this idea that our will as in our taking of responsibility and our taking and acknowledging of the gift of our incarnation is so important that you know, the spirits just don't want us to show up and go, tell me what to do, what should I do? You know, I'm going to hand over my will completely to you so that I do the right thing. Yeah. And to which, you know, in my world, the spirits cock a slightly sneering smirk and go, okay, let's have fun with this one.
Yeah.
Because we're here to do our will. Mm. Yes. And let it be that our will is in alignment with
the holy will. Yeah.
With the holy will, with the will of all that is good and beautiful and generous and reciprocal, etc. And, you know, yes, it doesn't have to be, but it must be our will.
Yes. Yes.
Because otherwise we are literally backwards sneering in the face of the gift of our mortality.
Yes.
Because we have been given free will.
Yes. Yes. I was just saying last night, what we have to understand, when anybody channels anything, they channel it. Well, I mean channeling, whether you're doing healing or just saying nice things or whatever, it comes through your psyche.
Yeah.
And the observer changes everything.
Yeah.
So whatever comes through us is transmitted according to how we communicate. And I could not transmit a teaching from God about quantum mechanics, black holes and deep physics because I don't understand it. I don't have the vocabulary. I wouldn't be able to receive the download, if you like.
Mm.
So if we haven't used our will to do as much clearing of us as we can and we open up to spirit, we have no discernment.
Yeah. In I guess, more in shamanism. In shamanism, what you're talking about is called being a hollow bone.
Yes.
And to be able to be a truly, properly cleaned out pipe of a hollow bone is to be able to transmit what the divine or what spirit
because
offers.
Because you have a clear boundary in the bone.
Exactly.
But if you don't have that bone, and your bone isn't spongy, so bits of it are going out through that going, oh, damp. And just adding damp to something can change the message. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
So how does that come back to Christianity and love?
Well, because I was just wondering, well, if those are the basic tenets of witchcraft, which has had rather a bad press over the last, say, 600 years, what are the basic tenets of Christianity?
Love thy neighbour. Love the Holy One, whatever one conceives it to be, with everything, all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. Put that first, your relationship with the all that is first, and then your neighbour as yourself. That's it. All other laws are subsidiary to that.
And your neighbour, obviously, everything. To us is everything.
Yes.
Yeah. But but too much of Christianity, it's just humans.
Of course it is. In all religions nowadays, it's just humans. Well, no, not all. I'm sorry, that's wrong. But with the Orthodox evangelical, it's all about the humans. Because we're the special ones. We're the ones with the rights and the privileges. Yeah.
Yeah, that whole blessing and blight thing, it's not going so well for humanity, is it?
It's really not going so well for humanity, no.
Or at least for consumer culture. Again, that is unfair. There are, you know, we in the West are entirely to blame for what is happening all over the place. And the majority of the people who are having the worst effects of climate warming, climate catastrophe, extinctions, etc., are in the places where we are not.
Yes. They're the places we don't need or want to exploit.
I know, I think we have.
Oh, actually, no, that's completely wrong, isn't it?
India, Pakistan, Amazon, etc. We've exploited the every kind of F word out of them, and now they are suffering the catastrophic consequences of our greed.
Yeah, we don't, they're places we don't need to care about.
Well, we do need to care about, but we're too fucking stupid to understand that we need to care about them.
That's what I mean.
Which, don't know why I'm laughing. Frankly, we should be absolutely sobbing
but
our guts
not.
Out.
But we're not. We don't care because we've come into this individualistic culture now, which is, it's all about me. It's all
but
about
even
my
even if it's all about me, I don't understand. Even if it's all about me, am I, too damn stupid to understand that I can't live if the planet is on fire? I cannot breathe if there is no air. I cannot eat if there is nothing growing, you know. No,
it's denial.
Yeah.
It's pure denial. I think I've mentioned this before, but I've got an acquaintance, a comedy acquaintance, who has irritable bowel syndrome. And she gets very nervous because she does a lot of comedy and she still gets very, very nervous. And obviously there's something going on, physical, mental, psychological, and you can actually see that. But as soon as she's finished a bout, she can't wait to get back to KFC.
Wow.
Or McDonald's. And she's always eating the rubbish stuff because she obviously doesn't want to look at any research about diet and IBS and obviously doesn't want to look at anything about emotional causes of IBS. And I can't make her.
No.
But she's not stupid. She's just disconnected.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Everybody has managed to be in denial or disconnect. Because if they took it on, it would just be too big. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, to me, that is the fundamental thing here, is that we are disconnected. Exactly that. Mm. And if we view the body of the earth as one body, if Gaia is just one woman, then she is suffering from really serious soul loss.
Yes.
And we, the humans, in a way, are the soul that she has lost.
Yeah.
And so we are completely in disconnection with the body of our body.
Mm.
And so we can't feel, can't see, can intellectually understand, but not emotionally or psychologically in a way understand what we're doing.
Yeah.
And obviously we're not all lost because then she would be dead. Mm. But the majority of those of us in Western consumer culture are a piece of soul that is lost. And so we have all the symptoms, or perhaps, no, we're not the soul that's lost, perhaps we're what's remaining, because we have all the symptoms of that disconnection, incapacity to feel, addictive behaviours, mm. destructive behaviours, all of those things that if we were just the one being, those are what we would be expressing because of this soul loss. Mm. And so we need to, as the one body of Earth, those of us who have the will, the power, back to will, to intend it, need to call ourselves back to our bodies, back to the body of our Earth, to remember our connection.
Yeah.
Before it's too freaking late.
Yeah. I think I've had a clue on how difficult it is for a lot of people, because you and I live outside the world. We're edge dwellers. Mm. We really are. So we have lived, and even though I'm far more corporate than you ever have been, you know, working in the media and that kind of thing, I've still always been slightly on the edge, because I've been a freelance, and freelancers aren't necessarily able to have standing orders never been particularly wealthy. And inheriting all the stuff from my mum's house and then going and clearing the retirement home, and she lived what I would call a zen-like life, really. There was very little there. But the very little there mounts up. I don't know what to do with it. All the plastic, the little plastic mirrors, the Anne French cleansing cream and the plastic oil of Olay bottle. Well, OK, I'll finish them up and I'll try and recycle them. But I gave up plastic stuff.
Mm.
I have my moisturiser comes from Kenwoodeen Aromatics in
a lovely glass jar.
In a lovely glass jar.
Yeah.
And it was a conscious search to find
something
in a glass jar.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you look behind you, there's a little bookcase and there's a shoebox in there and all sorts of things that are just plastic, plastic, plastic. She had 5 combs.
Wow.
7 boxes of tissues. Well, that's fine, I guess, but I don't know how good tissues are. They're just looking, and plastic pots to the nth degree and plastic bags. You wanted some for foraging. Yes.
Made me laugh, actually. Yes, I've come begging a plastic bag, because our plastic bags have basically, we use them and reuse them and wash them endlessly.
Yes, exactly.
But there are so many blackberries to pick this year that I've actually run out of things to put.
Well, I don't think I'm going to have to buy another plastic bag in for the rest of my life.
Well, I probably never will either. This one roll is probably more plastic bags than I've used in the last 20 years.
One of 6 that were in her kitchen drawers.
Blimey.
And this is a woman who cared about the environment. She was passionate about Gerald Durrell's conservation work and the zoo in Jersey. And we asked for donations to the Jersey Conservation Trust.
Wow.
You know, and she's absolutely passionate about it, but didn't make that connection. I need my makeup.
Yeah.
And until we learn to make the connections, we'll just keep going with the consumer convenience. I already talked about the dust thing, you know, the thing that you knock the old cobwebs down with, because I'm trying
feather duster.
Yeah, but a feather duster. I always had a feather duster, but she had 2 of these plastic ones, non-static.
Right.
Actually, 2.5, because there's a little one for doing tiny ornaments. And I sort of go, 3!
Oh, God.
3!
Yeah. I guess all you can do is give them to charity shops and...
Or use them for the rest of my life.
Yeah. If you're going to use them.
But yes.
So can I go quickly back to the idea that if we are part of the kind of lost soul of the greater body of Earth, then what on earth can we do about it? And what we can do about it is, number one, on a practical level, be aware that this is a thing and that our will is incredibly important.
Yes.
And that therefore, if we can direct our will and therefore direct our attention and be properly present to this knowing that I am part of the greater body of the earth, and therefore what I will, what I am, what I do is part of her and affects the greater whole, then the more I am in total and utter conscious presence to my own physicality, to my body, and to the bodies of all of what is around me. So present to the tree, present to the river, present to the beautiful flowers that Maggie has picked here. Present to that picking, to their scent, to everything. That the more we can call ourselves into presence with all else that is, the more we are calling ourselves home. And we are part of the body of the earth, and therefore we have the power to do this.
Yeah. And I think it was Neil Donald Walsh in Conversations with God many years ago who said this, said you start with the washing up. Because if you can't be present to the washing up, you've got no idea how to be present to anything else.
Absolutely. Because the way you do something
is the way you do everything.